2001 Salt Lake Sun Swing Symposium. Session 234. Author meets critics. Lucy's Book, a critical edition of Lucy Mott Smith's family memoir. Panelists: Brian H. Stee, Morgan Brent Adair, William D. Russell, Maureen Carr Ward, and Levina Fielding Anderson.
This being a very interesting session with a lot of questions, let's go ahead and start promptly. We'd like to welcome you to session number 234, which is Lucy's Book, a critical edition of Lucy Mack Smith's family memoir by Levina Fielding Anderson. Our panel members today are Morgan Brent Adair, who is a local book collector and an avid reader. He's reviewing Levina's book for Sunstone Magazine for an upcoming issue. Bill Russell, a member of the RLDS Church. He's taught at Graceland for 35 years. He's the former president of the Mormon History Association and is currently working on two books, one of which deals with the recent schism in the RLDS Church regarding ordination to priesthood. We also have on our panel Maureen Carr Ward, who has edited Mormon Historical Studies and is also the editor of the Winter Quarters, 1846 through 1848, Life Writings of Mary Haskin Parker Richards, which was the recipient, because of that book, of the Best First Book Award and the First Handcart Prize in 1996. Levina probably needs no introduction, and any introduction of Levina probably goes on for a half an hour, but she is the editor of the Journal of Mormon History. She's co-editor of the Mormon Alliance's Case Reports. She was the associate editor of both Dialogue and the Ensign, which in and of itself is kind of interesting. And she's authored or co-authored numerous books, all of which you can read on the back page of Lucy's book. I'd like to turn the time over to Morgan. He will start us off, followed by Bill Russell, followed by Maureen, and then Levina will offer her response. And then at the end, we'll take questions. Thank you.
We do not wish such a book to be lying on our shelves to be taken up in after years and read by our children as true history. It's transmitting lies to posterity, and we know that the curse of God will rest on everyone who keeps these books for his children to learn and believe in lies. The book Brigham Young referred to was the first edition of Lucy's book, published in Liverpool by Orson Pratt in 1853, under the title Biographical Sketches of Joseph Smith the Prophet and His Progenitors for Many Generations by Lucy Smith, Mother of the Prophet. Though he called the book a tissue of lies, Brigham Young's primary concern were with reining in the sometimes reckless Orson Pratt and ending William Smith, the brother of the prophet's, aspirations for high church office, which Lucy Mack Smith also supported. Brigham Young assigned George A. and Elias Smith to edit and correct Lucy's book so that an accurate edition could be published. Fortunately, many members of the church ignored Brigham Young's warning about the book because the corrected edition wasn't published until 1902. In the meantime, a generation of Mormons grew up reading stories of the young Joseph Smith, his family, and ancestors. Martha Cragen Cox said that her family owned only 6 books, including the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and the history of Joseph Smith by his mother. Martha said that in 1860, soon after I was 8 years old, the history of Joseph Smith by his mother was placed in my hands. I found a sunny place by the pile of logs, not easily seen from the house. In here, I secreted myself until I had read the book. Nearly 100 years later, those of us in my generation grew up in the church, seeing this edition on the shelves of our parents and grandparents, the pink dust jacket edition, edited by Preston Nibley, published in 1945, went through numerous printings, and I can remember seeing a copy on the shelf at my grandma and grandpa Adair's house. It's from Lucy's book that we get the familiar story of young Joseph Smith's leg surgery, that was told and retold in general conference, articles in church magazines, 2.5-minute talks in Sunday school. It was used to illustrate Joseph's courage, his love for his mother, his temperance, and the trials that he had to endure. In recounting her history, Lucy includes details that breathe life into the historical record. Consider her description of Joseph's reaction when he heard that Martin Harris had lost part of the Book of Mormon manuscript. "Oh my God," said Joseph, clenching his hands. "All is lost, all is lost. What shall I do?" I've tempted the wrath of God. I should have been satisfied with the first answer I received from the Lord, for he told me it was not safe to let the writing go. He wept and groaned and walked the floor continually. At length he told Martin to go back and search again. "No," said Martin, "it's all in vain. I've ripped open beds and pillows. I know it's not there. Must I," said Joseph, "return to my wife with such a tale as this? I dare not, lest it kill her at once. How shall I appear before the Lord?" "Of what rebuke am I not worthy of the Most High?" Sorry, that gets to me. BYU's Richard L. Anderson said, In a commendable effort to be objective, we modern historians have too regularly stripped away feelings from history. By doing so, we offer black and white shadows of the original colorful drama. Lucy Smith never came close to this mistake. Her deep feelings about her life are obviously related to her vivid memories of the appearance and conversations of historical personalities. This is social history at its best, and I suspect it told as few males would tell it. The new Signature Books edition of Lucy's book, edited by Levina Fielding Anderson, is subtitled "A Critical Edition of Lucy Mack Smith's Family Memoir." The family memoir aspect of Lucy's book is part of the reason Brigham Young found the work so threatening. Lucy Mack Smith's view of the origin of Mormonism was that it was the workings of God in the lives of members of her family. Lucy recounts her own visions and those of her husband Joseph Smith Sr. Their son Joseph Smith Jr. carried on the family's visionary tradition and was the most influential and charismatic member. While members of the Young Mormon Church may have viewed Joseph Smith as the founding prophet of their faith, Lucy viewed the church as an extension of her family's visionary charisma. To a certain extent, members of the church shared this view, referring to Lucy as Mother Smith. At the sight of Joseph and Hiram's bodies after their murder, Lucy's spontaneous reaction was, my God, why hast thou forsaken this family?" Little wonder that Brigham Young saw the claims of William Smith to leadership of the church following the death of the prophet and the support he received from Lucy as serious threats to the organization. A question that always seems to accompany the study of history in the LDS Church is that of application. As I mentioned earlier, Lucy's memoir has been mined for stories that can be used to teach moral virtues. Lucy's been used as a role model of a visionary woman and of long-suffering motherhood. With the church's emphasis on families, it seems natural to look to Lucy's family memoir for insights into the dynamics of the church's founding family. While some may find nuggets that can be extracted and used as examples of the Mormon ideal of family life, the size of this vein of ore is probably limited. The family of Lucy Mack and Joseph Smith Sr. didn't match the modern LDS ideal, as described in the Proclamation on the Family, and there's some evidence of dysfunction. I wouldn't expect the organizational church to embrace the Smith family as an ideal. On the other hand, there's much that we can learn by studying people who don't fit our ideals. Real life is seldom neat, not now, not in the 19th century. How many LDS women are in the position, as Lucy Mack Smith was at one time, of being the spiritual head of their homes? Lucy's story may have application to many of us in our individual circumstances, apart from its value as an object of scholarly study. Returning now to the subtitle of this Signature Books edition, "A Critical Edition of Lucy Mack Smith's Family Memoir," Let's talk about the critical edition part. As a visual aid today, I brought several editions of Lucy's History of Joseph Smith. There's this one published by Grandin Books. It's out of print, but still fairly easy to find. The Bookcraft edition and fairly new Covenant Communications edition are still in print. So with all of these editions still readily available, one's tempted to ask what's accomplished by publishing yet another edition. The signature edition, edited by Levina Fielding Anderson, contains the rough draft manuscript that was narrated by Lucy Mack Smith and recorded by Martha Jane Knowlton Corey, printed in parallel columns with the 1853 edition published by Orson Pratt. This edition pushes aside all the editors that have stood between us and Lucy Mack Smith and allows us to get as close as possible to hearing Mother Smith's voice. In this edition, Anderson has added a long essay on Lucy Mack Smith's domestic spirituality, a thorough textual history and publishing history of the book, a chronology and biographical summaries of nearly everyone Lucy mentions by name. With Lucy's book, Levina Fielding Anderson has made a valuable contribution to the scholarly study of early Mormonism. But in saying so, I'm afraid I also identify this edition's weakness. Aside, at least from the point of view of the people at Signature who are in the business of selling books, we would that all the Lord's people be scholars, but I suspect that given a choice between a volume of nearly 1,000 pages that sells for $45 and one a third that size and cost, most people would opt for the one with the pretty picture of Joseph Smith on the cover. The scholarly study of Lucy's book also presents problems to the organizational church. Lucy's account of Joseph Smith's visions don't match the canonical versions. There is evidence of the family's practice of folk magic that is for many problematical. Though the book doesn't present the threat to the church that did in Brigham Young's day, this suppressed, embraced, and analyzed book will continue to pose questions to those of us who study it. Thank you.
I wondered about whether or not I have a conflict of interest in being on this panel. When I come to Salt Lake City for Sunstone, I almost always stay with the Andersons, this week included. And, you know, when I think of my good friends, my many good friends among the Mormons, I begin by thinking of the Andersons. And, of course, that Dad Burn Cockroach, Melvin Smith over there. I was president of MHA the year after he was, and I had to kind of set the organization back in order. And then Barbara Hoagson, who I owe a great debt to her because she sends me the more interesting clippings from the press on religion out here in Utah. So maybe I can't be objective about works by people like Levina. But three considerations helped me overcome my initial reluctance. Number one, in Mormon studies, everyone knows everyone else anyway, and so you could end up refusing to review anybody's book because it could become what I like to call an incestuous review. And then secondly, I vigorously criticized good friends before, and some of them still speak to me. And thirdly, I have, you know, even though I'm staying at their place this week, I have other good friends in Salt Lake City. And I think I could find a place to stay tonight. I've got friends here I haven't used. And so for the 30 years that I've been in Mormon studies, my frequent harangue has been that as historians, we cannot assert that someone had a revelation from God. We have no way to prove or disprove such a claim. You know, we can only say Joseph reported that God appeared to him in the woods and said to him, "Join none of them, they all suck," or whatever it was he said. When we report these things as facts, we're acting as believers rather than as historians. Unless I miss some disclaimer, then Levina acts as a believer and seems to assume Lucy's accounts of miracles and healings and very specific prophecies actually happening and so forth. So although excommunicated, Levina is still a believer. I appreciated the fact that she supplied a ton of footnotes and excellent lengthy introductions and so forth, and great footnotes on Mormon history, plus 95 pages of biographical summaries. I love these kinds of appendices in books and so forth, and a 50-page chronology. And again, I love to see a good chronology. I didn't see any major mistakes, like Paul Edwards, his history of the RLDS Church. He left out section 156 in 1984 that tore the church apart. So she didn't make any major boo-boos like that, that I could see, anyway. And in her notes, I think she does a really good job of weighing the evidence in complicated cases, like, you know, who did this, and what, and where, and when did this happen, and so forth. All these things add great value to the book. So I think it is worth paying a larger price to Signature to purchase her edition. Because often I found myself saying, good Lord, I mean, she has really dug deeply into this subject. And I intend to refer to Lucy's book many times in the future. I think Levine is an ideal person to prepare this critical edition because of her research and her editorial skills and her painstaking efforts and so forth, her patience, I guess. Her interest in giving women the credit they deserve in a church that treats women as second-class citizens, and her continued faithfulness to the Mormon gospel, and her courage shown in the past and here again, as she's not afraid to criticize a prophet for truly outrageous behavior. It is my view that Mormonism arose in the worst period for American women with regard to the status of women in society. The cult of chivalry that placed women on a pedestal, which was really a rut, gave women in the early and mid-19th century less opportunity than they had in the colonial period, according to historians like Paige Smith. The women's rights movement is often seen as beginning with Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. The martyr died 4 years earlier, and thus Joseph Smith did not have the opportunity to consider the critique of society from people like Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Lucy Stone, Reverend Antoinette Brown, and also Frederick Douglass. Joseph died 4 years before the Declaration of Rights of Women, penned by Stanton at the Seneca Falls Convention. So we need to take this into account when trying to understand Joseph Smith and Mormonism and the treatment of women in Mormonism, just as we need to take into account the fact that Joseph died about 35 years before biblical scholarship became fairly well known in America. And so there are questions about biblical issues that would never have occurred to him. And thus he wasn't aware that some of the statements that he made about biblical matters would conflict with serious scholarly studies fairly soon, a few decades later. We've made major blunders when we've assumed biblical scholarship was wrong just because it conflicted with something that Joseph Smith had said. We must, you know, remember that he would never have considered these questions or these questions about women. My own personal story for myself would illustrate here. I had graduated from Grayson with a BA degree in religion in 1960, and 2 months later, I became an editor at the RLDS Publishing House in Independence. A couple of years later, a good friend of mine, who was a convert to the church, asked me, Bill, why don't we ordain women to the priesthood? As far as I know, that thought had never occurred to me before. I was 24 years old, had a BA degree in religion, and that thought had never crossed my mind. About 2 years later, I learned that Justice Abe Fortas of the Supreme Court, that his wife was also a lawyer. When I read that in the New York Times, I thought, what? I've never heard of a woman lawyer. I was 26 years old and had never heard of a female lawyer before. Certain ideas that are commonplace now were not even on my mental horizon because of the limitations of my culture. My own daughter is now a lawyer, and she got her legal career started when she was in the 8th grade and sued the state of Iowa over the basketball rules. Her life would have been much different if she'd lived with Lucy Mack Smith in her period. We have a problem because Joseph Smith's utterance ended up either in the official canon or the unofficial canon. That is our tendency to regard virtually anything he said as inspired. Yet Joseph's thinking reflected the culture and worldview he inherited, just as is the case with the biblical writers. The giants who wrote the Hebrew Bible uttered many great things, but they didn't understand that the world is not flat, and the sky is not the ceiling of the earth, and the floor of heaven, and the sun does not revolve around the earth. The Apostle Paul is the great genius, without whose genius Christianity might have died as a short-lived Jewish sect. But his inspired writings also were couched in a cultural understanding They regarded slavery as acceptable, and male dominance was simply assumed. But because we canonized Joseph's utterances, women have had a bigger obstacle to overcome in Mormonism than they have in other Christian denominations, because Joseph's patriarchal worldview, while very understandable, became the way we think God wants the world to operate. Similarly, we had a more difficult time getting rid of slavery because slaveholders had scriptural support from Paul. Slaves, obey your master. Thus, we owe a great debt to people like Linda Newell and Val Avery for their biography of Emma, and now we tip our hat to Levina Fielding Anderson for her careful study of Lucy's book, two extremely important women in our history. Lucy is a problem for the Latter-day Saints, both RLDS and LDS, I assume. It appears that Brigham Young banned her book because of her understandable affection for her son William, or her daughter-in-law Emma, you know, two of Brigham's enemies, or because it was published by Orson Pratt, whose theological writings distressed Brigham so. I've always thought that all of us Mormons, Lucy's history is really troubling because it suggests that many of Joseph's ideas and religious experiences might have come from mom and pop rather than directly from heaven, as we've been taught. Even so fine a historian as Richard Bushman recognized how sensitive the early history of Mormonism is when he titled his book The Beginnings of Mormonism rather than the more logical The Origins of Mormonism. The latter title would suggest what historians assume, that the movement arose out of the culture and historical context of the time. And of course, mom and pop are a big part of that. And Lucy and Joseph Sr. are an important part of the religious context for the prophet and the organization of the church. Bushman wanted to minimize the environmental influences, so he used that title. I do know that for the scholarly types in the RLDS Church who've engaged in serious examination of the origins of Mormonism, Lucy's book has often been an eye-opening experience for us, as we see the similarities between Joseph's canonical writings and what his parents thought, their dreams and visions and so forth. In Lucy's book, we see an elderly woman torn between loyalty to her son, William, and to Emma and her grandchildren on the one hand, and loyalty to the 12 and the many friends who went west on the other. Her choice to stay put in Illinois was a natural one for an elderly widow with important family close at hand. She should not be demonized for that choice. I hope sometime before the end of the next millennium, we can get over the habit of judging someone's contribution to the church on the basis of whether they continued as a member of the church for the rest of their life, or whether they chose the right faction when the church split. Milt Bachman, for example, only mentions Emma Smith three times in his fairly lengthy one-volume history of the Kirtland Church, and they're very superficial mentions. In fact, he has to kind of tell us that the brethren kind of had to help her with the hymnal. I suspect if Lucy had gone west, she would have gotten better treatment than Milt, but I can't say that for sure, of course. When someone leaves the church or is excommunicated because they've thought the wrong thoughts about God and written about it, why do we have to revise our opinion about them as a person and downgrade their past achievements? I have seen it all my life in both of our churches, and I'm really sick of it. We have a deplorable tendency, you know, to demonize those who are out of favor, and Levina's work here helps bring some of these to our attention. In Lucy's book, we see the strong Mormon appreciation of inheritance and lineage. Lucy at one point feels that her son William has inherited the office of prophet. But we, the RLDS Church, sort of inherited the family of the prophet Joseph Smith, including his crazy brother William. And so then we made the office of the president of the church an inherited one. This curse was not lifted until 1996. Your curse, seniority, has not been lifted yet. Levina makes a very good point when she indicates that the Lucy we see in her writings seems like the good Mormon woman, not only back then but today, as she would appear to be quite at home with the proclamation on the family, the somewhat recent papal statement by the First Presidency. Levina's point seems to be that you would think that the current church leadership would value Lucy, and it would have asked somebody to prepare a new edition that's currently in circulation of Lucy's history. Although I suppose the first presidency might not have asked Levina to prepare it. but still, so it's a good thing that she went ahead and did it instead of waiting for an assignment from the brethren. It is still the brethren, isn't it? I haven't been here for a year. My point here about Lucy fitting in well with the proclamation of the family would be slightly different than the one Levina seems to be making in her book. I would say, hasn't history moved us far beyond the limited perspective we had on the role of women in Lucy's adult life in the first half of the 19th century? So I would turn it around. The proclamation on the family seems very pre-Seneca Falls. It is as if we hadn't learned anything in the last 160 years. The proclamation reads like it could have been written before 1848. And that's what's wrong with it. It was written 160 years too late. My students in Latter-day Saint history gag when they read the proclamation on the family, given to me by a Mormon colleague, and so I shared it with my students. And why were the 11 witnesses to the Book of Mormon all men? Why wasn't Emma one of the witnesses, or Lucy? I agree with Levina that Brigham Young's condemnation of Orson Pratt and William and Emma and his belittling statement about Lucy are reprehensible. I was personally moved by this statement, to my mind, Levina's best sentences in the book. While it is common to admire, this is a direct quote here, while it is common to admire Young's vigorous expressions and to enjoy his hyperbole, it is no doubt much more entertaining and pleasurable to do so from a comfortable distance. There is nothing entertaining about Young's behavior in this instance. It is distressing to see the president of the church slander the mental competence of a 70-year-old woman when the documentary record shows otherwise. It is unpleasant to hear a man, revered as a prophet, sneer at a faithful mother of 12 who donated her time and sacrificed her economic well-being, dismissing her as a sensation-seeking would-be novelist. It is not edifying to watch him publicly browbeat, humiliate, and threaten an apostle with disfellowshipment over non-malicious mistake. And it is particularly disappointing to hear him justifying all of these behaviors by accusations that the book is a tissue of falsehoods, an accusation that on closer inspection is itself a falsehood. Excommunicating Levina didn't seem to shut her up. We do our church a great disservice if we're afraid to criticize our leaders. Leonard Arrington's otherwise fine biography of Brigham Young ignored his racism and sexism. Why must it be an inactive Mormon, Newell Bringhurst, who brings out the truth on these two subjects in a biography written at about the same time? When we cowardly fail to express our constructive criticisms of the church, we selfishly favor our own self-interest over the good of the church. When we express constructive criticism, we have chosen to put the good of the church over our own selfish interests. We are silent because we are selfish. Unfortunately, in the church, people tend to label such people as anti-Mormon, apostates, and so forth. We sometimes even excommunicate people who love the church so much they speak the truth to power. I was saddened by Brigham's order to hand over all copies of Lucy's book. If Gordon B. Hinckley issues such an order, he ain't getting mine. And I was saddened by Orson Pratt's capitulation to Brigham. And he was an apostle, for crying out loud. Our apostles would never capitulate like that. We've had debates in the Herald between apostles and presidents of the church. We need to recognize that our heroes have had plenty of flaws. Today we would label some of Joseph Smith's marriages, the 7 to underage kids, underage girls, as clergy abuse. We would label the 11 to women that were married adultery. We think of every conceivable explanation for polygamy except Joseph's hormones. Martin Luther King was considered by many as the greatest moral leader of the 20th century in America, and I agree, and yet he committed adultery. Both Smith and King were great men, but far from perfect, and we don't need to cover that up. I will close by telling how some of us in the RLDS, now Community of Christ, handle a matter of pressure from the hierarchy. A decade or so ago, the RLDS leaders hatched the idea to create the Graceland Park Press. Graceland and Park were the two colleges with RLDS affiliation. The idea was to have a press where the more academic-type books on religious subjects could be published without having them to be approved by the first presidency. In 1991, the first book came off the Graceland Park Press entitled Let Contention Cease. a collection of 9 essays on the recent division in the church over theology, edited by Lanius and Spillman. This is a sensitive topic, so I was happy to see the book published without having to be approved by the presidency, since I wrote one of the essays in the book. However, soon after the book was published, I received my first and only negative letter on my essay. It came from First Presidency member Alan Tyree. He opened with this sentence, "Bill, I am always surprised and sometimes appalled in this instance when someone of your intellectual capacity boldly states as fact something which readily accessible evidence demonstrates to be untrue." Well, President Tyree then stated that the one particular sentence I'd written was carelessly researched, and he concluded that I've embraced the position of the enemies of the church, the fundamentalists. Anybody that knows me, I think, would laugh at that. He then cites First Presidency statements in the Herald, which he assumes contain the real truth, in contrast to my error. But since I'd read those statements, and I regarded those statements as public relations cover-ups of a sensitive situation for the leadership, I had not embraced their position as historical fact. But neither had I embraced the fundamentalist interpretation either. President Tyree sent carbon copies of his letter to the presidents of the two colleges. You know, I teach at Graceland. So he's telling my boss I was incompetent because of a sentence that conflicted with his ecclesiastical self-interest. I was irritated, but you know me, I decided to hold my temper, and I wrote a polite response, and I noted that neither my paper as a whole nor the sentence in question embraced the position of the fundamental schismatics. But then I tried to humbly conclude, and I said, if the offending sentence means what you think it means, then I simply did not choose the right words. I thought that would end it. But imagine my surprise when his reply included these insulting words. "Bill, if you have difficulty with the meaning of the words you use, then I would not want you to interpret the meaning of the words I use. I will not be available to interview for your book." That was fairly clear. Now to quote the famous line from the movie Network, "I was mad as hell and not going to take it anymore." So I wrote a 5-page, single-spaced, scathing letter to President Tyree. He had sent copies of his letter to my boss, the president of Graceland, so I carbon-copied President Wallace V. Smith and the senior counselor, Howard Sheehy, as well as the various other persons that are mentioned in the correspondence. Meanwhile, President Tyree had sent a similar letter to Larry Conrad for his essay because he had a footnote wrong. I was, apparently contentions had not ceased as a result of the book, Let Contentions Cease. I was even more dumbfounded at his letter to Conrad, since Larry is a former RLDS member who's now a Methodist minister. Well, why is he trying to jerk him around? Larry, too, wrote President Tyree a scathing 5-page rebuttal. These letters soon began circulating around the RLDS bureaucracy by employees who were delighted to see arrogance in high places called to task. I was told by several headquarters employees, "Thanks, I wish I'd written that." But I believe I did the church and Tyree a favor by not knuckling under to his insulting, arrogant behavior. It is precisely because Tyree had great power that he needed to be told the truth. If he was a nobody, it wouldn't really matter. Ultimately, Tyree wrote a letter of apology, but not to me or Larry, but to Roger Lanius, the editor of the book. So I think Wally B. and Howard Sheehy must have put a little pressure on him. And so, to conclude, I'm impressed with Alvina's choice of topic, her scholarship, her massive research, and her candor. She has enriched Mormon history with Lucy's book. I see it as Levina's labor of love for Lucy and also her continued love of the Mormon gospel. Thank you.
I was contacted a couple of weeks ago to see if I would participate in this session, and because of my love of Levina and the work that she does, I said yes, but I said, I haven't really got time to do all this research. And they says, just read the book, stand up and tell what you like about the book, and or what you don't like about the book, or how it moves you or affects you. And I can say amen to a number of the things that have already been written. One of the things that I remember also as a small child, finding the pink book by Preston Nibley on my dad's shelf, and I read it at the time thinking it was just a history of Joseph Smith. and not realizing that it was anything more. I went back to see if I could find that, because I thought it was on my shelf. I had taken most of my dad's books, but apparently somebody else got to it, so I didn't. But one of the things that really touched me with this book was Levina's accounting and teaching and telling of the history and the background of Lucy, and what she was like and what she wanted to be as the mother, the Republican mother, she stated. And and of her family. And also another thing that I really liked was comparing the two versions of the rough draft of the way Lucy spoke compared to what the final things were. I published this, or edited, my second great grandmother's winter quarters journals, as was mentioned. She was from England, and I would not have thought of changing her words, because it would have come out completely different, the way she spoke from her regional upbringing. And in fact, the first typescript that I got of my Mary's journals were from a translation typescript that had been done at BYU many years ago, back in the 30s. And I had typed up one of those and didn't think anything of it until I went and found another journal that was at the church archives. And I pulled that up and I thought, this is not even the same. The spellings are different. The wording's different. The impression's completely different. And then I realized that somebody had cleaned up Mary's words. And I know for myself, when I write, and Levina will vouch for this, I definitely need somebody to clean up my grammar and my writing. But for me to take somebody else's words and rewrite them as if they were hers, Levina writes some of the literary techniques that Lucy used in her story. The suspense, where she said, "We were expecting him, Martin Harris, every moment. We waited till 9, and he came not. Till 10, and he was not there. Till 11, still he did not make his appearance." The colloquial expressions, when Thomas Marsh warns her not to sing or pray en route to Kirtland, or "we shall be mobbed before the next morning," Lucy reports her retort with a slangy relish. "Mob it is then," said I. "We shall attend to prayer before sunset, mob or no mob." And when somebody cleans these up, it just doesn't have the same spirit. A well-developed sense of dialogue, as in this exchange with her hostess for an evening outside of Buffalo. "What be you," she said she, be you Baptists?" I told her we were Mormons. "Mormons," ejaculated she in a quick, good-natured tone. "What be they? I never heard of them before." "I told you that we were Mormons," I replied, "because that is what the world calls us. But the only name we acknowledge is Latter-day Saints." "Latter-day Saints," rejoined she. "I never heard of them either." Regionalisms. "Here we found an own sister." And Lucy is quoting, but also paraphrasing, John Smith, her brother-in-law. An earthy and sarcastic humor is used by Lucy. She obviously enjoyed the irony of the prosecuting attorney becoming ill and vomiting at the feet of the judge, stressing the Missouri nickname of Pukes. Darker is her comment after the martyrdom that the mob had the kindness to allow us the privilege of bringing them home. Exhortation, exposition, and polarization. All of these things don't show up if you read the other. And another place that expresses these, Levina has used three parallels, one of the rough draft, one of the... Let me look and make sure I've got this right. The fair copy, Corey fair copy of 45, and one of the Pratt edition in 53. And the first one is human. It says something to you. And this was at the very end of talking about Joseph's leg operation and illness. She said, "After one whole year of affliction, we were able once more to look upon our children and each other in health. And I assure you, my gentle reader, we realized the blessing, for I believe we felt more to acknowledge the hand of God in preserving our lives through such a desperate siege of disease, pain, and trouble than if we had enjoyed health and prosperity during the interim." This is the fair copy that Martha Corey has cleaned up, and to me it's very sterile. After about a year of sickness and distress, health again returned to our family, and we indeed realized the blessing and felt to acknowledge the hand of God more in preserving our lives through such a tremendous scene of affliction than had we seen nothing but health and prosperity in the same time. You hear the difference? And then third one, to me, is a little bit more wordy, but it still doesn't give you that feeling that the first one did. Having passed through about a year of sickness and distress, health again returned to our family, and we most surely realized the blessing, and indeed we felt to acknowledge the hand of God more in preserving our lives through such a tremendous scene of affliction than if we had, during this time, seen nothing but health and prosperity. I also was impressed with her name glossary at the end. I like that, of the chronology. I did find one mistake, though. I did find one mistake, and I got to see if I can find it. Where you list, it's on page 165, where you list examples of trying to capture the notes. There's no number 7. It goes from number 6 to 8. This is my dad's training. Every book my dad ever read, he was in the printing business. We had Carr Printing Company out in Bountiful. And every book he ever had, he sat down and read with a red pencil. And I find myself in any type of a meeting with a program or anything, circling all the misspelled words and so on. So anyway, I just wanted to mention, throw a little twist in the Orson Pratt thing, and want to submit that Samuel W. Richards, as the printer, was more involved than just being the printer over in England. And I'm going back to page 97 and 98. Where it says that Pratt had taken Lucy's manuscript in May of 1853 with him. While he was in England, he arranged with a church printer, Samuel W. Richards, to have the manuscript printed. He told Lucy later that it has cost me between $2,000 and $3,000 in order to get the same before the public. And his biographer, Pratt's biographer, says that it never brought him any remuneration. The next page, again, they're talking about what happened to this copy, the fair copy. Did it get destroyed and ruined, left over there, written on? Did it come? Page 107, and I'm saying these for Bovina's benefit as well as for anybody that has the book. These pages. Young continued in talking about this subject. He says, "I do not know." Oh, okay. He says that the fair copy was obtained fraudulently from passed through Isaac Sheen, from whom Orson Pratt obtained the manuscript, and through this his greed for money published it in England. I do not know that Samuel W. Richards knew anything about the matter in which it was written or how Orson Pratt obtained it. He printed it as he would have done any other book. And then page 115. Does that tell me I have to stop? Okay. The final question is, even if Pratt did not know Young's possibly unspoken views on the manuscript, should he have asked permission from Young and the 12 before publishing? It's difficult to say so. It's obviously Young thought Pratt had committed an egregious affront by not requesting this permission. Equally obvious, Pratt thought he had acted innocently and even commendably as an individual, spending his own money and making his own arrangements. A little background, Samuel Richards had married his best friend and partner's wife, Elizabeth Whittaker Kane, after the death of his partner. And in 1873, he and Elizabeth were involved in a land dispute with Brigham Young, and Brigham was Samuel's cousin, first cousin. But they were involved in a land dispute, and Samuel and Elizabeth were excommunicated by Brigham Young and the general authorities in 1873. And Samuel and Elizabeth were not allowed to be at the court, and they were refused permission to receive the minutes of the court. Because of this and some other problems earlier, Samuel was financially in trouble. He took out bankruptcy a couple of years after that, and it wasn't until Brigham died and John Taylor, who happened to be the brother-in-law of Elizabeth Whittaker King, had them rebaptized and later sent Samuel to be mission president in Eastern States. Anyway, there's a letter, because of his finances, he wrote a letter November 16, 1878, Elder Orson O. Pratt, dear brother, and I'm going to read most of this. I trust no apology for needing will be needed for the liberty I take in requesting your consideration of the following facts, which the severe pressure of unfavorable pecuniary circumstances induced me to state. I have spent considerable of my time in former years on missions of the church. Late action, President Young and others, through his influence, has served to so embarrass me in circumstances that I am unable to suitably provide for the warmth of a large family who are now looking to me for the necessities of life and social advantages. And a cousin of mine recorded this into a tape recorder, and the tape had to change right here, so I'm missing part of it. With propriety that I might apply for such favors as might aid me in my necessities and do no injustice to others. In doing so, I am persuaded that a former business transaction with yourself, if fully considered by you as to how unfortunate it was to me, while advantageous to you, might, if your pleasure could afford me such benefit as I could deeply appreciate. I refer to the purchase of me, by me, of the edition of The History of Joseph Smith by Lucy Mack, Lucy Smith, his mother, while on a mission to England in 1852, 3, and 4. When by your request I made the purchase of you, I did it in good faith that the work was of value, but had no doubt that you sold it to me in like good faith as a business transaction, but it proved otherwise. I was not at the time prepared to make such a purchase, and to aid you to the extent required, I was under the necessity of borrowing money and found that it required the careful savings of a three-year mission to accomplish and then left me in debt. To realize something as early as possible from the work, I went to the expense of importing 1,000 copies to Utah when freight across the plains was very high, and they were demanded to be given up under threatened implications of a curse rested upon anyone who would even dare to retain a copy in their possession. Thus, the loss of freight and other expenses was added to that of the original purchase money, and all this without so much as being asked by President Young or by Brother Pratt how seriously I was affected by the loss. I came home from that long and arduous mission almost without means, without horses, stock, or even money enough to finish off a small house I had commenced before leaving, and found myself in debt. Even I did not complain, looking forward to the time when I might be able to realize something from the work purchased of you. When the edition was ordered by President Young to be destroyed, my disappointment was complete, and all without one word of explanation or sympathy from any source whatsoever. Notwithstanding all this, I struggled along, thinking I would never name it to anyone if it was not spoken of to me, but as my necessities now are probably much more pressing than yours were then, I simply ask, will it be your pleasure to bear with me a portion of this burden and grant me a little immediate relief, instead of me making a demand upon the church for the amount of the loss sustained by the action of the president, its president. I have no inclination to inquire here where the responsibility of the loss is that transaction rests if I had made the demand upon President Young. But be assured, Brother Pratt, I have not attached blame to you. I simply wish to know your mind and feeling upon the subject that I may act accordingly. While President Young was with us, I did not wish to call up anything that would aggravate feelings relating to the past upon which he seemed very sensitive. It's an understatement. Now, as you are favored with a more controlled position, while mine has not improved by reason of his determination towards me, I feel it would only be just and right for me to realize some benefit from the transaction. And went on to say how his family needed help. Isn't that interesting? As soon as I go and do a real transcription, I'll send it to you. But it's like, did he actually purchase this? He's the one that did the whole thing. Just another couple of spots. So I quickly went through all of my transcriptions of Samuel's journals, and I know he wrote journals all the time, but a lot of them are missing. They're always the key ones I'm looking for that nobody in any repository has. There is nothing, we don't have any journals available during that 1853 period of time. There is nothing during the 1855 period of time when he would have been told that these couldn't be there. However, Saturday, 8th of October, 53, he said he sent a copy of the work Joseph Smith, the Prophet, and a letter to Orson Pratt in Washington. In November of 53, he sent a letter to Orson Pratt informing him of having forwarded the balance of money on account of the work Joseph Smith, the Prophet, and one to H.S. Eldridge to learn how much assistance I could depend on him for immigration. But during the part where he bought the manuscript, if he did in fact buy it, there's no journals. February of 1854, he packed two cases of books for the Valley, told about how much it weighed. March 54, he wrote to Orson Pratt with an invoice of books. In February of 55, he went up to Brother Al Snow's house and took five volumes of books to put in the library belonging to the Polysophical Society. That's written like Pollyanna. Two copies of Joseph Smith the Prophet and some others. On March 55, he wrote a letter to so-and-so and one to Brother N.L. Scoville of Provo and sent him two dozen copies of Joseph Smith the Prophet to sell for him. He sent one dozen to Brother Obrey in Tarilla. So he acts like these are his books. In April of 55, he went with Mary to Frank Pullins and got some flowers to set out in the front yard, and a tame rose bush gave him in return a copy of Joseph Smith the Prophet and some flower seeds I'd brought from England. And then this, in December of 66, this is the only other time I can find a mention of it, he mailed a letter to Franklin, and I forgot to look to see where he was living or whether Franklin was over in England or whatever. And he mentioned all the stuff that, in the letter, and then he says the next day on the 5th, inquired after engravings, plate of portraits, and my own, my account with Joseph Smith the Prophet. And so Clarion's is 66. He's struggling with this. So my belief is that Samuel Richards was a victim of Brigham's tirade, as well as Martha and Howard Corey and Lucy and Orson Pratt. So that's something that we might need to explore. And you know what's crazy is I've had this in my files for 5 years and I didn't even know what it meant, you know? I just, that's interesting. Until I started going through the book and I thought, now I understand that. Anyway, I really have enjoyed the book, and I'm looking forward to taking the time now to actually go through the meat of it. I shouldn't say the meat of it, because I think the beginning and end are the meat too. And really read Lucy's own words all the way through and do the comparisons. Thank you. Fabulous.
Well, you've seen a living demonstration about the ongoing dialogue that is Mormon history right before your very eyes, that I am so excited by this development of Franklin Richards. When I saw that he didn't have an 1853 diary, I thought, well, it would have been nice to know what he thought when he first saw it, but I guess there's just nothing to add to that part of the story. But the victimization of Samuel W. Richards, I think, is absolutely true. I think it's extremely telling that he waited till Brigham was in the ground for... December? That letter was in December?
November 16th.
Okay, so Brigham had been dead for a year and a few months before he brought the topic up, and you can see, in view of Brigham's reaction, why he didn't want to do it while Brigham was still alive. But this wonderful incremental development, this line upon line of how things come forth is I think really exciting. One of the discoveries that I love the best in doing the research is something that is really sort of inconsequential in a way, but it's something that has never been nailed down before, and that was, how did Orson Pratt get the manuscript? There are five different versions of how the manuscript actually came into his hands, including Brigham Young's accusation that Isaac Sheehan stole it and that Orson Pratt juggled and jiggled it into existence and implied and was actuated by a sense of greed to do so. Well, in Horace Eldridge's diary, Horace was in charge of the church in St. Louis at the time, he mentions that not Isaac Sheehan, but Almon Babbitt, who was the church's representative to Congress, came through St. Louis, said he'd been up to Nauvoo and had got Mother Smith's manuscript and was taking it to Washington, D.C. For Orson Pratt. And when Almon Babbitt came back 5 weeks later through St. Louis, he had effected the transfer. So we not only have a date, a very tight window of time, but we also have the exact transmission. That was something that nobody knew before, because nobody had stubbed their toe on that entry in Horace Eldridge's diary. And I think that that's just one of the really exciting details. Now, what happened to it in England was a closed book to me. All I knew was that Orson Pratt took the manuscript, went churning across the Atlantic, primarily to do genealogical research. He'd come across another person named Pratt, it's not even clear that they were related, who had done a lot of research and had a lot of names, and he was willing to share them with Orson Pratt. So Orson dashed across the Atlantic to do a little more research. The myth is that he was mission president at the time. It's not true. He was mission president in England 10 years later. So he was doing genealogy. He also engaged in a family history project of some significance by getting married. And he was back in Washington, D.C. no later than 11 weeks later. So he clearly did not spend a lot of time in England supervising what happened with the publishing of the manuscript. It really makes sense that Samuel Richards had a very important role to play in that part, and he certainly had all of the technical work to play as far as that went. But what's not clear is how that happened. And the sort of assumption is that the pink volume, the Nibley version, is basically the one that Orson Pratt did. It's not true. The differences between the 1844-45 fair copy, which is the pretty written out copy with correct spelling, punctuation, quotation marks, paragraphs, chapter headings, is very, very close to the, especially in terms of substance, in terms of actual content, very, very close to the version that was actually published in 1853 by Orson Pratt. So Orson Pratt did not affect most of the changes. There's another blank between the rough draft and the fair and the 1853 version, and that's where the fair copy comes. We don't know the mechanism of production between the rough draft and the fair copy. We know how the rough draft was written. Lucy talked and Martha wrote. But then what happened? Did Martha say, when they were working on the fair copy, do you want to say it this way? Or did she say, okay, this is what you told me, but is there another way you want to say it? How much was Lucy involved in the production of the fair copy? It happened while she was alive. It happened within just a few months of finishing the rough draft. So she was obviously available, but we don't know if she said, oh, just do the best you can, or make it sound right, you're the school teacher, or if she said, no, that's not right, we need to say it this way. So there's this sort of black box that the rough draft goes into, and the fair copy comes out. Now, up to this point, there's been sort of the black box that the rough draft went into, and Orson Pratt's edition came out. So there's this middle manuscript that where actually most of the substantive changes were made. Now, the church would not give me permission to publish the fair copy. I asked twice, and they would not grant that permission, and they wouldn't give me a reason either time, and the director of the historical department refused to meet with me because he said he had nothing to add to the letter. So there's another black box, and maybe someday we'll find out what that is. But I wanted to, I have a visual aid here. this is, as far as I know, the first modern Lucy Mack Smith artifact. It was it was produced by Ann Romig, who is the wife of Ron Romig, who's archivist of the Community of Christ. And since he and Bill are roommates at our house tonight, this week, she very kindly made this as a little gift. And I love it because Lucy has not been she's been mentioned twice in connection with the Proclamation on the Family. Was she a model? What could she have been a model for the ideal Mormon family today? Or wouldn't she? Was the family dysfunctional? Or wasn't it? And I think that that's something I hope to explore in the biography of Lucy Mack Smith that I'm working on now. But the real problem is not how Lucy has been used. Morgan, would you hold up the book with the pretty picture of Joseph Smith on the cover? This is Lucy's book, and whose picture is on the cover? Now, the problem is that Lucy has just been invincible. Her book has been important because of what it said about Joseph Smith. But the fact that she was saying it has not been important. And that's, I think, the aspect that we need to explore. All of the entries in the journal history of the church before 1830 are taken from Lucy's book. The description of what church history consisted of before the first documents were produced in 1830 come from Lucy. But nobody says, what was Lucy's perspective? How did she approach this? What were her biases? What did she consider to be important? And I think, I need to do a lot more work, but I think that we have sort of blandly assumed that Lucy was a Puritan granddaughter, and that if we understand Puritan New England, we can explain a lot of Lucy. I think that is profoundly true in ways that we have not even understood yet. Plus the fact that she married into a family that executed witches. Joseph Smith Sr.'s one of Joseph Smith Sr.'s ancestors in the direct line was one of the judges at the Salem witch trials, who condemned women to death. And so if you're talking about Joseph Smith's the orientation toward women of the pre-Seneca Falls Joseph Smith, I think that there are many, many aspects that deserve additional exploration and confirmation. Now, I think that Bill's mentioned that we have an entirely different framework from which to approach women's issues is absolutely true. I think that the fact that it has taken... how long has Lucy's book been around? It was the first... history published of this period of the church, and it has taken this long for someone to do a critical edition of it, and it's still an incomplete critical edition because the fair copy isn't included, and there's no biography of Lucy. There's a biography of Joe. I can't count how many biographies there are of Joseph Jr., and a biography of his father, but not of Lucy, even though both of them rely heavily on Lucy for information about their biographies. Now, Morgan mentioned that the strength of this book, its 1,000 pages, is also its weakness, that people probably won't read it. I think that's probably true. It's not meant to be read. It's meant to be a resource because it's a documentary comparison. There are the text of the two versions, the rough draft and the 1853 version, and then the footnotes are not substantive footnotes. That information is in the chronology and the notes about the people who are meant that she mentions, but the footnotes are all about the variants that were added. The RLDS version was the only book in print between 18 Well, whenever Brigham Young called in the 1853 version, which was 1866, until the 1902 version. The RLDS Church kept it in print for those crucial three decades. There are the corrections by George A. Smith and Elias Smith, and I also include the variants from the Improvement Era edition and how Preston Nibley handled some of the same material. And those editions are still in print, as Morgan has pointed out. You can still get what is basically a 1902 edition of Lucy Mack Smith's history. The ironic thing for me was that after all of this tempest in a teapot that Brigham Young launched, the 1902 edition did not go back to the Lucy's rough draft, or even to the fair copy. It used the condemned, banned, burned 1853 edition. and whatever corrections George A. Smith made on that edition. So there are many, many ironies in that particular historical episode. I think that the question of demonization is a really interesting one. I think it's true that if women didn't fit in the category of faithfulness, and Mary Fielding Smith is the best example of that, that they were demonized. We've seen the demonization of Emma and the restoration of Emma as a full person in Linda and Val's biography. But I think that Lucy wasn't demonized as much as she was just forgotten. I think most people, because of the Preston Nibley version, didn't even realize that there had been this banning of the book, not in the 20th century. I didn't know about it until long after I'd read the Preston Nibley biography, version of the biography. And I think, well, how many of you did? How many of you knew about the banning? It's something that just dropped out of our historical memory. And so I guess maybe we could say that this is part of the restoration of all things. I do want to leave plenty of time for questions, because we have a very knowledgeable panel here. And of course, I'll be happy to answer them too. But why don't I just turn the time back to you, Brian, and have you take over.
What we'll do is, like they did in the last session, if your question is quick and succinct, and I'll restate it for the tape, otherwise we would ask, if it's a longer question, to come up to this microphone here so that we can capture it on the tape. And then if you have a specific individual you'd like to address the question to, please state that also. I guess by virtue of being the chair, I'll throw out the first question, because this is a question that's plagued me ever since I read Lucy's history. And I'll address it to Levina, because she's obviously the panel expert on this topic. Would you classify Lucy's history as being dependent on the then published or at least recorded history of Joseph, or does her history, particularly of the pre-reorganization period in Joseph's life, is it an independent history? And specifically as it relates to the first vision, because obviously, at least in reading your edition, Lucy was familiar with Joseph Smith's history and apparently brought in large sections of the 1838 history into her history. But yet when it comes to the first vision episode, it's almost like she's avoiding Joseph Smith's history and telling her own recounting of what happened with Joseph Smith as it relates to the first vision. So how do you interpret that?
Well, she actually quotes Joseph's 1838 first vision version. When she gets to that point in the history, it's just copied from the Times and Seasons version, which differs in a couple of interesting ways from the version that we have in the Pearl of Great Price. For instance, it identifies Moroni as Nephi, which is, you know, interesting. And he and Joseph, where Joseph says that his feelings were poignant, her version, which follows the Times and Seasons version, says that my feelings were pungent, which I think is a vivid variant. But when one of Martha Jane's notebooks, it's the only one that still survives, contains a little outline of events that need to be included in the history. And about halfway down the list is the first vision, but it's not listed in the same order as everything else. It's slanted off to the side and has been obviously inserted later, even with a different with a pencil that is blunter than the others. So in the initial outline, it looks as though they either forgot the first vision. And as Brian pointed out, if your son came home and said he saw God, don't you think you'd mention it, or don't you think it was important? Yes. So why does Lucy overlook this event? And it's not uncharacteristic. It's not just the first vision. Whenever there were events on which there were where there was published information, such as the 11 witnesses, she just picks that up from the published version, and it makes, I think, for sort of awkward chunks of narrative that have just from someplace else just dropped into her narrative. And the rough draft says, "See Times and Seasons, page 308. Start here and go," and then she gives the final words that she wants to have quoted. Part of that, I think, was to save time. Part of it was that perhaps she was deferring to a more authoritative version, and maybe she didn't want to tell one version of the story and have Joseph's version tell a conflicting version. But I also think where the first vision was concerned, that there may genuinely have been some confusion in her mind between the visitations of Moroni and the first vision. The chronology is very confused during that time period. She really only lists two identifiable visits to the hill Cumorah. The sequence of the timing of the first vision is not clear. Now, Joseph Smith later says that he came in and leaned on the mantelpiece, and she asked him what was wrong, and he explained that he had found out for himself that the churches were not true. But Lucy doesn't report that. And I can't help thinking that even if you say parents expected their kids in the 19th century to go out and have some kind of epiphany to show that they were saved, I still think that that would have been important. So I think that there's some really interesting values that we just tend to read back into that history that really are not there, that Lucy really did perceive it somewhat differently. I have answered your question at great length, probably at excessive length.
Any questions?
I wanted to add, excuse me, considering how important this book is for the source, consider the kinds of things that we think are important in church history that don't appear in Lucy's book. She does not mention the first vision, the restoration of the Aaronic priesthood, the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood, the fact and date of her own baptism. She does not mention that. The word of wisdom, the school of the prophets, the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, the appearance of Moses, Elias, and Elijah, the second vision in which Jesus Christ accepted the temple, the importance of Zion's camp as priesthood training, which is how we use it now, the selection of the Quorum of the Twelve, the organization of the 70s, Danite activity in Missouri, the establishment of bishops, the law of consecration, the crucially important missions of the 12 to Great Britain, the creations of wards, the organization of the Relief Society, the practice of polygamy, and Joseph Smith's U.S. presidential campaign. She talks about the publication of the Book of Mormon, but does not mention the publication of Emma's Hymnal, the Book of Commandments, the Doctrine and Covenants, or any of the early Mormon periodicals, with the exception of Don Carlos's involvement with the Messenger and Advocate. Although she was endowed, sealed, and had received her second anointing, she does not allude to any of these events, nor to the major Mormon doctrines of premortal existence, marital and parent-child sealings, the three degrees of glory, the preexistence, the nature of God as a glorified man, vicarious temple ordinances, or the miracle of the mantle of Joseph that reportedly fell upon Brigham Young. Now, if you were sitting down to explain Mormon history to somebody who wanted to know about it, probably you would mention most of those things. They are not in Lucy's history. And so we need to think, what was her history for? What was she writing it for? She was interested in her family. And she presents the history of the church as the struggles of her family to bring forth the gospel. So to do that, she casts her family as the virtuous, patriotic embodiment of American morality. One of the really interesting things is that her father had this conversion experience that is very close to her own, a vision in the night, a voice speaking scripture to her. But she doesn't mention any of that in her father's history. Instead, she tells about his experiences in the French and Indian War. And she does that, I'm convinced, to show that her family is a patriotic American family, and that her family is betrayed by the nation because the elected officials of the country would not defend her family when they were being persecuted. And she does have a metaphoric view of the entire church as her family. She considers herself to be the mother of the church, as well as the mother of the Smith children. But she positions herself rhetorically as the Republican mother who is betrayed by the Republic, but who is staunch to Republican beliefs and to religious beliefs. And she collates the two, so that civic virtue is the same as religious virtue.
John?
What was Lucy's reaction to the death of Joseph and Hiram, and how, if it did at all, how did it differ from her reaction to the death of Alvin, her husband, and her husband?
Okay, the question is, how was Lucy's reaction to the death of Joseph and Hiram different than the deaths of her other children?
Well, Alvin's death was a gigantic trauma. She documents that in detail down to conversations. I think that both Jess Grosbeck and Bob Anderson have documented this family trauma that precipitated a family dysfunction that Joseph's established restoration in some respects since set straight. Now, in terms of the deaths of Joseph and Hiram, there is a page missing from the rough draft, and it's the page where the murders would have been described. And I'm sure that what happened is that somebody at the archive said, "Hey, look at this," and it got passed around and never got put back. But that page is missing. So what we have is her report of seeing the bodies for the first time, and Morgan quoted that, and it's a very moving passage. But I think even more moving is a letter from Sarepta Haywood, who said that she came to visit Lucy just a few days after the martyrdom, and Lucy was in the mansion house in a room with some other people. The only other person she mentions is Lucy's daughter, Lucy. And she took Sarepta's hand, and they wept together, and she said, "Why would someone want to kill my boys? What harm did they ever do? And Hiram, he was so mild. Wasn't he always so mild, Lucy?" And then Sarepta said, "But I've got to end this letter because my husband's waiting to mail it." So we don't know the rest of that conversation. I think that they function, the deaths function with a rhetorical difference in the narrative, because she can't blame anybody for Alvin's death except the doctor, whom she does blame. But the deaths of Joseph and Hiram were the conspiracy of the nation to suppress God's work. And she goes on from the deaths of Joseph and Hiram to this really sort of out of control denunciation, in which she guarantees that she's going to be there at the judgment seat to bear witness against Martin Van Buren and Governor Ford and the mobbers and Carl, who am I thinking of? The governor immediately preceding Ford. Carlin. Yes, and she is looking forward to condemning them to hell with her testimony. So, and that's different from the function that Alvin's death served.
Good answer. In the whole study that you made, what is the, you would see as the highlight of something you didn't know before, like comparing the doctor, that's, is there anything substantive there that you didn't know that you didn't learn about?
Well, there are two omissions of incidents that I think are interesting and significant. One is that, as you're well aware, there are a number of scholars now who interpret the Joseph Smith family as seriously dysfunctional. They see Joseph Smith Sr. as alcoholic, and Joseph and Lucy as subject to chronic depression. I don't see the same evidence as I don't read the documents as persuasive in the same way. But in view of that view of family dysfunction, one of the incidents that is in the rough draft but is omitted from the final version is a tea party that Lucy is invited to from the ladies of Palmyra, including the minister's wife and the wives of leading merchants. And they are sitting around talking, and someone in an apparently patronizing way says, "Oh, Mrs. Smith, it's too bad you're living in a log cabin. You deserve something better." And she says, "I'm the richest woman here, and I'll tell you why. I know where my husbands and sons are, and they're not hanging out at the grog shop like yours are." And and she says the wives nod their heads and sadly say, "Oh, how true, how true." Well, did it really happen that way? I don't know, but that's an interesting incident. The other one is just a paragraph long, and she talks about how they were doing, how in addition to their farm work, they consulted the faculty of ABRAC, which is short for Abracadabra, and is a casual and very matter-of-fact acknowledgement that they were involved in occult activities. But it's clear in the context that was one of a long list of things they did, including, you know, the farm work, and they did not neglect their duty, she said. But that has been omitted from all subsequent versions. And, you know, you wonder why. You know why it was omitted from some but not others. Oh, one of the additions that Morgan didn't mention that is worth mentioning is that I think that the most readable and probably the best I don't know what you'd call it, one-volume, non-critical, non-scholarly version is the enhanced, revised and enhanced edition by Scott and Maureen Proctor. They took material from the rough draft. Oh, thank you. and they worked it into the narrative, but they don't tell you what they're doing, and they don't tell you where they leave things out. And they sometimes add things without telling you where they got them. So it doesn't work as if you're doing scholarly work, but if what you want is a story you can read to your kids, this is the best version.
Why did Lucy get Alvin's death date wrong in her history?
Everybody got Alvin's death date wrong. Joseph Smith gave us a choice of four different years. And I don't know why. I think, you know, the sequence is really important because Alvin's death logically had to precede the revival and the first vision. And I think that I think that it wasn't clear in the Smith family that perhaps psychologically they thought this was such a watershed in the year that they would never forget it. She does get the month right, but the years are, you know, that span of years actually runs from four different years, and because of it, I think that it locks us into trying to date the first vision in some difficult ways. I know that you've looked into that question a little bit, Ron. What's your conclusion? Well, and I'm even wondering if maybe Martha Jane had something to do with that, because Martha had only been a member of the church for 2 years, and what she would have read would have been the published version. And so she said, well, Joseph said he was 14, so that would have been, and, you know, she could do the math, and Lucy must have thought, well, I thought Alvin died in, but maybe I'm wrong. It's interesting.
Now, my understanding was that Alvin died after the first vision and shortly after the first Moroni visit. Is that
the first Moroni visit? Uh huh.
Right.
But before the revival, and after the revival. But the dating of the revival also depends on, was it really 1820 or was it 18? Yeah. We do have the expert on that dating sitting over here on our right.
Question? Go ahead, then you.
I was thinking 2 years ago someone mentioned in the talk of John Stone that Lucy had written that Joseph was telling Book of Mormon stories to the family before they were in a place or so on. Did you come across that?
Yes, it's in the rough draft, and it's also, I think it's in the 1853 version. She talks about them sitting around the fireside, a very contented and happy family group, and he would relate instances of their fortifications and their animals and their warfare, just as though he had been there.
Does she put any sort of context as to when those conversations occurred? Was it pre-1823 or post-1823? Does she put any sort of... Was it Joseph's imagination, maybe, or was it after he'd been instructed by Moroni?
It was after he had met Moroni at least twice by his dating and at least once by hers.
Okay. So did he know the place was forthcoming yet?
Uh-huh.
At that time?
Yeah.
No.
And she attributes the source to Moroni, or Nephi as she calls him, so that you get the impression that Joseph had told that Joseph had a number of visits and got a sort of orientation to Nephite civilization and was passing these tales on to the family. Uh huh. But that implies a sort of casual, ongoing, Moroni showed up and told me another story tonight. That doesn't quite square with the once a year, on the right night, at the right place, you show up and get instructed for 30 minutes and told to come back the next year. So there's that little bit of internal discrepancy. Well, I'm not really the expert on that. Where's Michael Quinn? But I think